We will get straight into it. I'm going to pray, and then I'm going to speak. On this first week, there's not really any sort of formal question times. For the next couple of weeks, I can do more question and answer stuff, but this week is kind of foundational. So it's just easier to just kind of go through it rather than, you know, get you to do lots and lots of questions and discussion and everything else. We can do that a bit later on. So this is foundational. If you get through this week, it means you're going to be all right for the other weeks, because the other weeks drill down into the specific topics and then sort of join it up with the foundational stuff we're doing this week. So, do you get the idea? If you get through this week and you survive, then the next weeks are easier. But the idea of these autumn schools is they are supposed to be stretching. So it will be a bit conceptual, and there will be some longish words, like the one on the second page, which is anthropology, which is just worth knowing, or autonomous and kind of words like that. So it will be stretching, but hopefully it won't be unreachable. Let me pray, and then we'll get into it. Gracious Father, we're so glad to be your children, to be under your care, to be adopted into your family. And we pray as your children to a Father that you would graciously speak to us this evening. Help us to understand ourselves and understand your world better. And may that be for your glory. Amen. One thing I wanted to say at the very beginning is that we all need to remember the gospel as we go through this. We need to remember the gospel for a number of reasons. Of course, it's always good to remember the gospel. So you're looking there, Matthew. So I might have my flies undone. So. It's okay. It's always a danger. We need to... You don't have to love my body. We always need to remember the gospel, because it's always good to remember the gospel. But in particular, remember the gospel because probably as we do this week's and as we drill down some of the other weeks, you might get a bit depressed to think about kind of social trends. So we need to remember the power of the gospel to change lives and to reform societies. So think about that. Remember the gospel from that point of view. But also remember the gospel because in some way or other, one or other of you might have been affected by some of the issues that we're going to talk about here, either this week, sort of more in passing, but as we drill down in the following weeks when we think about abortion or infanticide or IVF, as we think about the hookup culture with casual sex, sex without commitment, as we think about homosexuality, as we think about gender changes, in some way or other, you may have been affected, involved, participated, sinned in some way in connection with any of those things. And when we get into the kind of meat of it, I'll mainly be just talking about the issue, talking about kind of where it comes from, talking a bit about what's wrong, what's going on. But I just want to say at the outset that all of us need to remember the gospel of grace. You see, there's lots of things that we've done that have offended God, and it may be some of the things in this very area that we're talking about. But the glory of the cross is that Jesus took the offence for us. And it wasn't just for the little offences. It wasn't for just, sanitised sins that our cultural background has kind of stopped us from committing worse things. It's for the worst sins that all of us have offended God. Whether we've sinned in these particular areas we're going to talk about, or whether we've sinned in other areas, we've all offended God, but that offence has been taken by Christ. We've been forgiven. We have a status as redeemed new believers. I got distracted by the muffled noise from the next door. So just remember that if you're a Christian here tonight, you're completely pardoned, forgiven, redeemed, clothed with Christ. You have the status of son or daughter, and nothing that I'm going to say will contradict or take away from that. So that's the first thing. Remember the gospel. And if I remember to remember the gospel, I'll try and say it in some of the other weeks as well, just to keep bringing us back to that. The purpose of what we're doing, and it's really on the notes, I'm just going to say a bit more waffle around these notes really, but the purpose is to understand some of the thinking behind wanting to do some of the things that our culture is very comfortable doing. So for example, killing the unborn and the unable, using our bodies in different ways to the ways that they were evidently designed and intended, homosexuality or gender changes, or forsaking the commands of God in terms of how our bodies to be used. So not so much to do with the natural law of how things seem to be designed for, what things seem to be designed for, but also going away from what God has said. So we're going to think about some of the thinking behind that. Now, you could just say, well, it's just idolatry or it's just sin, but it's sometimes helpful to think about the kind of history of thought that's led to particular actions and see if that kind of helps us. It's based on this book called Love Thy Body by Nancy Piercy. Mark read it and was studying it, and I wasn't quite convinced, but I read it and I was reasonably convinced by some of the arguments. I didn't think the fundamental things she talks about carried across to all the areas that she said it did, but actually as I worked through the book I discovered it did. So you might, when I first start talking about it, why are you laughing now? Oh yeah. Yes, it's the wrong spelling. You're right. Yes, you're absolutely right. No, it's good. It's spelled like it is in this book here. I reckon that the publishers know how to spell her name, but when I was writing my notes last night, I clearly didn't. So don't Google the wrong book. Thank you. Do you pick on your class when they're smiling and say, "What are you laughing at?"
Yes.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. So it's fair dues then. Okay. So it's based on that book, and we're going to work through some things. Before I talk about the actual kind of philosophy, why does it matter to you? I mean, some of you turned up because you might be interested in the topic. Some of you turned up because you looked at all four and thought, oh, I don't know, that one doesn't look right, and I don't like that one. I've done that one before, so I'll come to this one. So you could have all kinds of reasons for sort of being here. Let me give you some reasons for being here. Understanding how people think is going to help us love them and speak to them in ways and words that they can understand and maybe lead them to Christ. So that's why we're doing this kind of cultural engagement stuff. It's not just kind of like, you know, interesting study stuff, and we can say, oh, I understand my society a bit better now, and, you know, this is based on the Greco-Roman dualism, did you know? So we can then sort of impress our friends at parties. It's more about understanding how people think, or even the thinking behind how people act, which they may not even be conscious of, which just might help us to love them more. Is that okay? Any questions so far? Any other typos so far? Don't want us to be outraged. Don't want us to be judgmental. I'll tell you a funny little anecdote. It's not really that funny, but I was at an event today at Westminster Central Hall, and Westminster Central Hall, it's the Methodist Central Hall. You've been to it for events and various other things, and it's not like it was founded by John Wesley, but the Methodist movement is founded by John Wesley, amazing preacher, travelled across the country and so forth. So I'm downstairs in the cafe, which is called the Wesley Cafe, or Wesley's Cafe. So I'm downstairs in the cafe, buying a coffee, I'm in a queue. Got some on this side, got some on this side. And they know each other. I've somehow broken into their little party, and they're sort of chatting across me. And eventually the one in front of me in the queue, she's a bit chatty. There's some Japanese that butt in, because they come from the queue the other way, so we're having a bit of a laugh about how these people are all butting in, and they're ordering 3,000 coffees or something. So we're thinking we should have pushed them out of the way and stood up for our rights. But so she says to me, she says, "Where are we?" So the person who's her mate on the other side says, "We're in like some museum somewhere." So he said, "Yeah, like some museum or something. You know, it's just a coffee room in a museum." So I thought that was very parabolic. So I said, "No, we're in Westminster Central Hall. It's like the centre of Methodism. Methodism was found by John Wesley, who was this amazing preacher, and this is why the cafe is named after him." And they're sort of looking across each other and saying, "Oh, that was it. That was the end of it." There was no resonance and no interest. which was just a little parable for our kind of post-Christian society. You know, these weren't the Japanese tourists. You could kind of forgive them for not knowing about Methodism. These were just, you know, ordinary people who spoke like me. So we live in a post-Christian society, but it's a society that's been influenced in all kinds of weird ways by both Christian thinking, Enlightenment thinking, post-Enlightenment thinking, post-modernism, modernism before that, post-modernism, post-post-modernism, existentialism, and Greek philosophy and everything else. So it's kind of a whole hodgepodge of influences that people might not even know about. You see, the weird thing about these people in the queue is that although they know nothing about John Wesley and probably nothing about the church because they think it's just a museum, loads of their values will have been shaped in some way by Christianity and distorted by some of the things we're thinking about tonight. There's a bloke called Steven Pinker who I'm writing about in a blog, which might come out in the next couple of days. He was on a program called Morality by Jonathan Sacks, the chief rabbi, and Simon Howe pointed out to me, it's a fantastic program, but it's 45 minutes each episode, so it gets a bit boring after about five of them. There's 15 episodes. But they're fantastic in that they leave you to almost, if you weren't a believer, slit your wrists, because they're striving for a definition of morality, but they can't find one because they have no authority. So this bloke called Steven Pinker, he's a very interesting biologist and anthropologist, studier of human beings, and a kind of philosopher. Do you know what he famously said? So I'm really going to speed up in a minute. Do you know what he famously said? There's an amazing chapter in his book about the evolution of speech. And what he says in this book, this has nothing to do with what I'm talking about, by the way, but it's a fun story. He says in this book, there's no possible explanation how speech could have evolved because it is so complex and conceptual. There's no possible way. So you think, okay, that's good. Perhaps he's going to say, you know, God must exist. So what he then does, he talks about an elephant's trunk. And he talks about how many muscles there are in an elephant's trunk and how they can smell from like 10 miles a rattlesnake and how they can lift up a cup and they can operate a pencil and draw and everything else. And he says, the trunk is so sophisticated, it couldn't possibly have evolved, but it did. Therefore, speech could have evolved. It's a fantastic, ridiculous argument. If you understand how illogical that is. It's just saying, well, it's here, and it must have evolved, because that's my worldview. And he does exactly the same with morality in this talk that he's giving in this talk of morality, because he says, we don't need Christianity. In fact, we need to evaluate religion by our morality. So you say, oh, interesting. So how are you going to evaluate it by morality, the standard moralities? And so the rabbi says, you know, what is the standard morality? And he says, well, it's the kind of humanist standards of, you know, treating people how you want to be treated yourself and trying to use your education for the benefit of others and a couple of other things like that. And he has absolutely no clue where that came from. Why should you do that? Why on earth? He's like an evolutionary biologist bloke. Why on earth do you want to use your knowledge for the benefit of others? Really? So we're all drinking from a very complicated set of influences. Okay, I'm going to really stick to my notes now. Let's get with it. What we're going to think about tonight is one of the streams of influences that's been building for a long time, but is perhaps, you could say, a bit more kind of recent, the way it's worked itself out. And it's all about that first heading, number one on your sheets, the autonomous self. But before I get into that, is there any questions about what I've rambled on about so far? Any points of clarity needed? Would you like me to go a bit slower in the way I'm speaking? Faster? Louder? Okay. Right. Here's a bit of interaction. What is a human being? Is that your definition? Is that God's definition? That's right, though. Good question. But I'm not answering it just at the minute.
Made in the image of God, by God.
Okay, that's certainly a good biblical definition. So a human being is made in the image of God. Adding to Matthew's bit, though, what did Matthew say?
Man with a conscience.
Okay? So, we are, to some degree, an animal with a conscience made in the image of God. Something that elevates us from being a mere animal, but are we a creature? Could we never be defined as a creature? Quite so. So we're a creature. You might say an animal, but you might think that animal's not a helpful category because it puts us in the sort of animal kingdom, but you might. You might say we're a mammal because that's another biological definition of us. Sentient is a good word. What does sentient mean?
Self-aware.
It means that. It includes that.
We have five senses.
It tends to include that as well. So self-awareness and sensory, it's even more than just ability. It's a kind of an evaluation and a bit of a conceptualize of senses as well, rather than, you know, ants have got senses, but you don't call them sentient beings because you don't think they have a kind of both a self-awareness and an ability to sort of conceptualize their pain and try and kind of work out what's going on in a sort of big sense. Now, you can have a bit of debate about whether some of the higher animals have some degree of sentience and what that all looks like, but we're not going to do that right now. So, that's a human being. What is the self? What do you think the self is? How would you define the self? The self as distinct from, perhaps, the body. So what's the self?
It's the identity God has given you.
The soul?
Could be. What does the identity God has given us mean?
Individuality.
Well, he knows us by name.
And where is the self?
Inside.
It's an interesting question as to where it is. But yeah. Inside, like, you know, it's inside the skin, like it can't come out of the skin, or
emotions or just spirit, isn't it? It's like it's just
the heart.
It's not in your like head, is it? It's not in your like in the brain.
Yeah.
It's really when you start thinking about the
question, you know? It's your person.
Personality.
Yeah.
More than inside your body.
That's quite.
So we are body and soul combined, don't we?
You see, the thing about the self is that it's both contained by the body, but not entirely constrained by the body. Like I know this is not literally what's going on, but I can close my eyes and I can pray and imagine Jesus Christ in heaven at the Father's side in some kind of vague picture. Now, of course, I haven't left my body and I'm not really there, but in terms of where this thing is, because it's not spatial, so it doesn't really matter, but in terms of where it is, it's somewhere else, isn't it? I can imagine Caroline, she's a bit crook actually, so I can imagine her lying on the sofa, so I'm kind of there already. I can imagine a future that hasn't happened yet. I can imagine me getting old and grey and bumbling and unable to remember my words and all that kind of thing. So in a way it's not constrained, but in another way it is. It's really helpful to think about that because the self is not independent of the body, but it is different to the body. And those are really important things to kind of hold together. We are, as human beings, what's often called embodied spirits. That's the best kind of theological way of talking about it. We are embodied spirits. We're never meant for eternity to be disconnected from the body, but the spirit does have a kind of a life of its own. Why it's also really helpful to know this is because when we think about the Holy Spirit indwelling us, it's very easy to get some kind of spatial thing going with the Holy Spirit as well, and to think that somehow the Holy Spirit's in, and like if you cut your finger off, you just, you know, cut a bit of the Holy Spirit because he's kind of everywhere. Or was he just inside your heart? You know, was he in your leg? I got into a discussion about a Muslim about this once, and I was like, what would be the word? Embarrassed, because I thought, I hadn't really thought about this. Because he said, where is the Holy Spirit exactly on you? And I thought, what a brilliant question, and I'm like an idiot, because I've never really realised that it's kind of an analogous expression, the Holy Spirit's living in you. It's not untrue, but it's not quite in the way you think, like, you know, like he's just inside you, but he is in your spirit, which is where? Well, it's embodied. So the Holy Spirit is embodied, but it's embodied in the same way that your spirit is embodied. So that's good to know and think about. Are you feeling stretched? I'm feeling stretched. And I had a chance to look at this before. So feel stretched. It's good to get your brain stretched. Right, we're talking about the human body. Put my glasses on so I know what's going on. Sometimes you might think the self is just a bit looking out by your eyes, but then you think about blind people, they've also got a sense of self and looking out. So it's not just, it's not entirely to do with senses, it has an existence in itself. And just as a by the way, the existence of self is one of the foundational arguments for the existence of God, the design of God. Because actually, personhood is this amazing phenomenon that's not just the product of the brain, it's something else. Now this is important because we're going to whip through some bad thinking about the separation, some bad thinking, but the Bible does have a view about a distinction between the soul and the body. It's just wrong how you might start to define that. So when we talk about some things in just a minute, just a second in fact, you might be thinking, well, doesn't the Bible have that view? Well, it sort of does, but it sort of doesn't. And that's what we're going to try and drill into. Okay. So in the ancient world, and it's probably easier to think about in the sort of Greek-Roman world, the time Jesus was around, there was mostly this, what you'd call a dualistic view, you know, it just means two entities view about what it is to be human. And lots of variations, but mostly was the idea that there was the body here and the spirit was on a kind of another level altogether. And again, mostly the thought was that the body is bad, like the body is a bit rubbish really, but the spirit is pretty good. You know, the spirit is all right. And you know, the best way to sort of higher spirituality, getting closer to God, being more happy, is to get more and more spiritual and kind of not so bodyish. Of course, none of them could kind of practice it, but that was the kind of philosophy. So that dualist philosophy was there. Dualistic philosophy was there. Spirit good, body bad, as it says on the notes. Now, the sort of modern twist on that, which builds on that, and lots of other things I haven't really got time to go into, but just to kind of get to the destination, is what's called personhood theory. And if you Google personhood theory, you will actually read lots of stuff. Some of it's Christian and some of it is secular, defending the idea of personhood theory. So it's not just something that the person who wrote this book made up. It's a real live issue in philosophical discussions. And after this session, you might think, well, it better just stay there in philosophical discussions. But you might think, oh, I understand how it connects now. So the modern twist is personhood theory. And personhood theory is this. It's I've tried to put it really simply on the notes there, which is you've got this distinction between the person and the body. So the person is this entity that's self-aware, that's social, that's embodied, that's sentient, able to think and feel and imagine. And by various definitions, here's something that I haven't got in your notes, but it might be worth writing down. Here's a quote from one of these thinkers that says, a person is an entity possessing sufficient mental capacities to be considered a person. Ooh.
So that makes abortion okay, because fetuses don't
quite
have
so
to qualify for that.
Quite so. So in this weird twist, you separate person from body, which we would have some sympathy with in a way, but you separate it to the point that you say, here's the person, and actually we'll start to define as a community when that person is really a person. I'll explain why it's quite convenient in a moment to do that, quite convenient but wrong. So that's the person. I'll say about the body and then perhaps you might have a question about it. The body is an expendable biological organism. So isn't that weird? It's almost kind of Greek, really. But you got the person, and we'll decide when you're a person, but you've got the person operating over here, doing all its stuff, thinking, feeling, being allowed to live, being not allowed to live, up here. And then you've got the body down here, which is basically just a receptacle with no value, no dignity, and in a way, no inherent purpose. It's really important to think about that. No inherent purpose. It might be useful to you as a person, but it has no inherent purpose and connection with the body. Now you might think, oh, that's a load of rubbish, what's he talking about? But when you start to drill down into all those issues, you suddenly realise, oh yeah, that works for that. Because you see, what happens is when we separate the... If you've got any questions, so I'm not trying to catch up, if you've got any questions like wasn't fast enough,
no,
slow enough... Okay, cool. When we separate the biological entity from the person, then the community can decide whether that person exists. And then the individual authentic self, this is quite a big phrase, the authentic self, the individual authentic self can decide what to do with the body. So here's the thing. State decides when a person's a person and when a person's not a person. The individual person decides, within some limits that the state might set, because they've got all these Christian influences, the individual person then decides what I'm going to do with my body. And that's really powerful as an argument. And actually, when you start to listen to things in that way, you think, oh, I understand now. That does work like that, because lots of individual selves around us are deciding to act out in their bodies just what they fancy doing, with no kind of regard for the body. They've kind of disconnected the two. And they thought the person is the thing we must worship, and my person in particular, and my person can do what it likes within sort of the constraints of my body. That there's some things that maybe I can't do, but other than that, I'll do whatever I want, because the body's just this biological bit of material with no purpose, no designer, no meaning, can be used for anything. You know, it's like, I should have thought of some better analogies than this, but it's like using a fork to get ice cream out. Come and think of some better thing. But it's just a thing that you can use for whatever you want, even if that wasn't its design and intended purpose. Okay, better analogies needed, but you get the idea. And the thing about it, if a body is material, just a load of material, I can do with it absolutely what I like. If it's just like this chair, this is probably not a bad example, but I'll pick it up anyway. If this chair has no moral commands placed on it and no intended purpose, I can do with it absolutely what I like, can't I? I can use it for firewood, I can use it to sit on, I can chew it, I can use it as a hat. I can do whatever I want with it, because there was no intended purpose. But if there was an intended purpose, and there was ownership of that, and there was design that went into it, that slightly changes it. But in personhood theory, the idea is my body has no inherent purpose. It just evolved some things that kind of made it function. And it does mean there's no right way for it to be treated, and there's no right way to treat it, and there's no right way to use it. And you would recognise this more from just general atheistic thinking, that if we simply evolved, the universe is amoral, without morality. There is no ought in the universe, and that would include my body. There's no right way I should use my body. Now, people haven't gone all the way with that thinking. They're just doing it in little, kind of biting off little pieces of that, because everyone realises instinctively that there is morality behind the universe. It's another really big argument for the existence of God. If you read the blog article in about 2 or 3 days time, it mentions that a little section about morality and good arguments in favour of morality. But if you're in an amoral universe, nothing like that matters. So you can do with your body what you like. So that's how personhood theory works. You separate the person from the body, and then you can do what you like with the body. You just have to kind of abide by the will of the collective, meaning the will of the community. That's what I mean by that. So, you know, as communities, we might still make some laws about what you can do with your body, but that's about it. It's very interesting to think about, not all the examples we're going to look over the next few weeks, but just to think about organ donation. Now, I don't know whether you've put your body up for organ donation. I have lots of arguments with Caroline about this, about whether it's, from a Christian point of view, a good thing or a bad thing. But as a matter of principle, who owns your body after you die? Does the state own it? Does the state decide what to do with it? Is it just some biological material, or did it have some significance? And does it need to be treated with respect in the way that it's buried and so on, to kind of signify that? If it's just biological material, just get rid of it in the most convenient way as fast as possible, because it has no significance. Anyway, go on, you say. The answer is that there's no answer. In terms of organ donation, we might argue as Christians whether we should or we shouldn't, whether they're all benefit. You can argue as a Christian, well, you know, I'm not going to need my body in the new heavens, the new earth, because I'm going to have a new resurrected body, so it doesn't matter. And, you know, I could have been blown up, or I could have been buried at sea or whatever, or eaten by sharks. So you can argue that. The counter argument is more to do with, is the body significant or special, and should we mark that in some way, in the way that we bury people? And my leaning is I'm not arguing against organ donation as such, but my argument would be against if you took a body and just kind of took everything out of it, and there was kind of nothing left, and you know, you just buried a few bits that you couldn't sell to anybody, is that the right thing? Maybe it just doesn't show the body that much respect.
Why do you need to?
Because we recognise that the body wasn't just a receptacle of ourselves, that it had significance as well.
Yeah, and
maybe we're showing some respect to it as it dies. So that's how the argument goes. So why wouldn't you just have a bonfire every week and just throw all the bodies on it? No, but like a bonfire in the street every week. For whoever died that week, you just throw them on the bonfire.
But then are we on the same lines of like Jehovah's Witnesses, in the way that they wouldn't like take a blood transfusion or something? Like, so if
absolutely not.
If Violet needed like a new organ or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm pretty sure I wouldn't say no.
I wouldn't say no either.
But then I don't
stand a point. Okay. My point was that. No, you're making a perfectly reasonable point, and Caroline would make this point the same way, except I'm just saying, symbolically, not really, not in practice, not that it changes anything at all, I'm just saying symbolically, things that say the body was just a bunch of cells, I don't think is helpful. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Or whatever is not residing within, around, on, anywhere near that body.
It depends on what organ it is as well. There is also that bit, because there's certain things that as Christians. Like IVF, for example, and there are some things to do with that.
What about brain donation?
Why not? If your personhood's not in your brain, why not?
Well, I think the point is that I'm not sure you can make quite such a simple separation. And, yeah. Do you know what? We're going to halt this discussion on that, because it's not going to get us anywhere. Hear me right. I'm not arguing against organ donation. All I'm saying is, and it's just proved the point actually, that it's a kind of an area that's not one of these other more straightforward areas, but there are lots of spin-off areas where you start to just think of the body as a bunch of biological material to be used at will. It has implications, and you need to think through things like that. I think through, and I came to a conclusion that I think it's fine to do organ donations, but I also think that through, and my preference when I die, and there might not be enough room, I'd rather be buried than cremated, because I just think it says something different about the significance of the body, that's all. I don't think it means anything. I don't think it means I get to heaven any quicker. I don't think it has any significance other than it's just making a statement. That's all. And you can shoot me down for it, and I'm not saying any of you should agree with me, but I'm just saying it's an extension of the kind of thinking. What do you want to say, Philip?
What am I going to look like in heaven? There's a lot of questions that we have that we're not going to find answers to in this life.
Quite so. Yeah, yeah.
I think you're right about the cremation, death, and burial thing.
Yes.
But I think the other thing for me is that many cultures use cremation as a statement about body and spirit, and so they're burning with purpose.
Yes.
In their heads.
Yes.
And so I prefer not to associate with that, and say burial is far, far better for the Christian. Because you're separating yourself, anything in that way. But that's just me.
But here's a different point there about here's a different point about organ donation.
I've been cremated. It's just who I am.
Yeah, and that's fine. And we cremate people who are Christians, so it's not like we have a big matter of principle about it. But it's just where I'm just showing where my thinking kind of led me on those two topics. But it was. Who should decide about organ donation, though? You as the donor or the state?
You as the donor.
The state wants
it. They want to, don't they? Mm.
That's wrong.
I think it should be you're opted in until you say you opt out. Mm. That's what they want, isn't it?
Is that actually not true?
No. I think as somewhere, isn't it? In one of the United Kingdom countries.
Northern Ireland? Was it Wales? Wales?
I think it was Wales. I think it was Wales. Yeah. Okay, so the consequence of personhood theory, we're at 20 to 9, so we're doing all right. We're still on page 1. And you can, of course.
Can you just revisit that definition of personhood?
Personhood is an entity that's self-aware, social, embodied, sentient. And a person, the community could decide, has moral and legal rights, but the body has no moral imperative and no legal rights. It's only the person that has rights.
So was that the definition that you then led you to the abortion?
Mm. It did, but I'll show what the consequence is and how that works.
No, I was thinking of it the other end of euthanasia.
It works that way as well, yeah. Sadly. It works at all end. And
as well, because yes. Certain people with, say, disabilities, yes, that can't necessarily speak or whatever, people could argue, oh, they haven't got, I don't know, being self-aware or sentient either. It's ridiculous, most levels, but people could argue that, and they have in the past, haven't they?
There's a horrible case in the Netherlands at the moment, isn't there, where the lady or the person they were tried to put down, put bluntly, was rejecting the idea, although she'd given permission to be put down, as it were, at some point in the future, but she said, not now. And they said, no, we're going to do it now.
Yeah.
So it's bizarre.
Yeah.
And awful.
So, consequences. Consequence of personhood theory, if nature is amoral, without morality, we can impose our will on it, my will as the self, or the will of the collective on the body, if nature is completely amoral. So how that cashes out, just to sort of connect with Roger's point, you can carry out any bodily actions at the will of the self or at the will of the state. You can carry out any bodily actions that you want. They may be against the commands of God. They may be against obvious design. They may be against truth, like saying you're a 3-year-old Vietnamese child when you're a 56-year-old male from Edward's Eath. So they can be against truth, but it doesn't matter because the truth is now embodied in the self, not embodied in the body, embodied in reality. I can get sexual satisfaction against the design of my body, against the evident design of my body. Nobody argues that human bodies are evidently designed for same-sex sex. Nobody would argue that. They would just argue that I have this attraction, it kind of, I can kind of make it work. So I need that satisfaction, I deserve that satisfaction, I have a right to that satisfaction, so I will bend my body out of shape in order to make that work and to do that. And that's because my body's just a servant of this self, and it has no moral consequence what I do with my body. And you see, the reason I'm you know, got us all lost in the, and I'm sorry about that, got us all lost in the organ donor thing is that the Christian view is not quite as simple as that. Like that, there's the soul here and there's the body here, and the body doesn't matter, because the body is where the soul is, and the body plays out actions which either respect the design and the command of the Creator, or they don't. It's not the self that kind of independently respects the design or the command of the Creator. It's the body. So if I come and thump you all around the head with my fist, it's with my body that I'm acting in a way that's not as much against design, because I'm built for this kind of fighting. Well, I was once. But it's against the command of God. But if I want to use my body in some other way that distorts the obvious design, it's fine. But it's my body that's doing it. It's fine in this person theory, but it is my body that's doing it. It's not just my soul that's doing it. It's my body that's doing it, because that's where it all cashes out. If I want to say angry words to you, they're coming out of my mouth, which is my body, isn't it? It's not my soul that's doing it. It's my body that's doing it. So you can't separate in quite the same way things like that. Okay, so in personhood theory, let's just take it a bit further. Morality is a social construct. I'm sure you've heard that before, haven't you, about morality being just what societies can agree at a particular time. It has no permanent authority. Just like Steven Pinker earlier, talking about him, has no moral authority. There is no permanent authority. There is no permanent ought. Now here's a scary thing which also works with this theory. Do you know Charles Darwin in the end, what was the name of his book? Origin of Species. Shall I tell you a funny thing about Charles Darwin? Not very funny. To do with species. Kind of in the end, he said species don't really exist. Which is very interesting, to say the least. Species don't exist. Modern biologists would say, well, they're kind of useful categories, so they're not saying, you know, there isn't such a thing as mammals or fish or whatever, but they would say as an envelope of a category, it doesn't really exist. Species don't really exist. It's completely fluid, so it's fine just to mix them up. In other words, and again, you might think it's okay, and I think it's probably okay to have a pig's heart. But the logical extension of that thinking is to say species don't exist. So why not? What would be the objection to having a, you know, half goat, half man? You're all saying, oh, that's appalling. People would never do that. It's the logical consequence. If some of the...
Make a half goat, half man.
Yeah. What would be the moral objection outside of God to doing that?
We're on that road, aren't we, in terms of genetic manipulation and three part embryos and so on. Yeah. Well, there's so much going on we don't even know about.
It's horrendous, really.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's all right in that, though. we like him. Now again, I don't want to get into an argument now about pigs' hearts and whether a child who's got a severe heart disease is allowed to have a cow's heart or a pig's heart or a pig's liver. And
I
don't know.
A valve. Yeah,
sure. My dad would never have survived. My dad would never have survived without insulin from cows, I think it was, or pigs, because before they synthesized it, because he was a diabetic. So, I'm all for it in one sense. But you've got to have some thinking that says the body is not just biological material. It is a distinct species made by God in the image of God. And it wasn't just the soul was made in the image of God, and then the body, don't matter. There's something going on with the two together, and you can't separate them in life. Taking life is only wrong if you've kind of got to these points already, but I'll just say them out loud just to underline them. Taking life is only wrong if what's being killed is a person. And if you decide that this person either isn't a person anymore, or you decide that the person doesn't want to live anymore, then you can take their life, you can harvest their body parts and everything else. Really, some bioethicists, people who are biologists who kind of talk about how you should do stuff, they would justify the killing of Alzheimer's patients, infants born with disabilities, people in comas, and they should be killed, or, which is also a little bit frightening, and you might think it's okay, but let's suppose you've got someone in a vegetative state, but they're basically kind of functioning in all other respects. Why wouldn't you do animal experiments on them? Why wouldn't you get like cigarettes and burn them on them and see what the effect is and see what, because their body is completely functioning, their heart's pumping and everything else, but why wouldn't you do that? Why wouldn't you see how their brain experiences pain? On someone in a coma?
Yeah.
They do experiments?
I'm sure they do.
I don't think they do. I don't think they're allowed to at the moment.
Are you sure?
I don't think you're allowed to.
You used to do it.
That was
the Nazis. Yes. I really... It's a good point. Pardon?
The Nazis
definitely. Yeah. Well, the Nazis did, but that's... Yeah.
But again, that's how they justified all of what they did, by saying that the Jews and others were less than...
Quite.
Subhuman.
Yeah.
They did this very thing.
I did see a documentary recently. I think it was one of the Scandinavian countries where they're trying to breed out almost Down syndrome.
That's yes.
Iceland.
Is it Iceland?
Yeah.
They bought every Down syndrome figure. It's horrendous. Yeah. I don't think they've had any Down syndrome children born in the last 10-15 years. It's quite amazing.
I think it may well be compulsory. Yeah, compulsory execution, I think. Otherwise it doesn't really mean anything.
Like in China, where you're only allowed to have one baby.
Yeah, but they don't kill the babies, I don't think. Do they?
Oh, you get infanticide.
Oh, they abort, yeah. So they don't... Yeah.
Yeah, but even if they're like...
No, it's a fair point, yeah.
Abortion and infanticide in India and in China, where you want male children.
Yeah.
And then you've got the birth imbalance.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's all good. Why do we think, by the way, that God created species?
Because it says each of their own, in their own kind.
Yeah. Whereabouts?
Genesis 1.
Yeah, Genesis 1 from 11 onwards, it uses... did I put it in your notes? I can't remember. Maybe I didn't. It uses kind 10 times from Genesis 1, 11 onwards. It uses the word kinds, so various species after their kinds, and the word kind can be translated species. It's to do with a category with sharing common characteristics. So kinds is pretty significant, and humans is a different... designed and a different purposed species. And actually, there's a similar argument that extends to surrogacy and IVF and all those kind of issues. It's not quite the same argument, but it's a similar sort of argument, which is that we kind of break out of God's design and we break out of God's command, but because we're just harvesting biological cells to achieve a purpose, our purpose of wanting a child, for example. So it's satisfying the self that happens to be stuck in this body, but we want to create another receptacle for another self, but we don't care how that's done. It's all part of the same argument, actually, because it's, yeah. Does that resonate at all, that making, because I found it quite helpful to think about both the command of God and the evident design of God, because I think those two things go together. So when we talk about, say, and you have to be kind of careful about this, and we've had lots of discussions recently about IVF and various things, but it's perhaps more straightforward when it comes to homosexuality, for example, that there are at least three reasons why it's wrong. One is that it's clearly not using the body as it was intended. One is that it's clearly not using the body as God commands. And the third one is that it's not allowing humans to model in their relationships the love of Christ and the faithfulness of Christ for his church. The fourth is that it doesn't allow families to develop in that complementary way with the way that God's designed the world. So there's probably a fifth and a sixth, but those are reasons. But they're a combination of obvious natural design with command. Can you see that? Right, anyone want to say anything before I go on a bit more? Anything about that? Do you think that makes sense? Do you think it's just kind of all theoretical? What do you think?
Surrogacy is interesting. Let's dig a bit deeper into that.
If God, as a married couple, has not allowed the circumstances where you can conceive children naturally using your own material, put it, yeah, that'll do. Here's a question: how far do you go in trying to overcome that? And that's really the. That's a very interesting question. But surrogacy is a way of overcoming that, isn't it? Depending on what you implant in that surrogate, it may be the sperm and egg. Is that what you call them? From what do you call the egg? You don't call it an egg, you call it an ovum or an ovary. Is it an ovary?
No, ovary is the main story. It's the organ where they come from.
Okay, good.
Ovar is plural, ovum is singular.
I never listened to biology to all that stuff.
Okay.
Just
that's why it's easy.
Yeah, that's right. All I wanted to do was cut out pig's eyes. That was the fun bit. And, get told off and slapped around the head. An ovum and a sperm joined together could be both from you. You put it in someone else's body and you think, is that okay? I've kind of moved out of God's natural kind of order of things, but is that okay? And then introduce someone else's sperm or someone else's egg or some other process. And all these things are hard to reason through. But if...
It's easy to reason it through in the context of what you've said about personhood, isn't it? In that morality world.
Well, it is, but it's also really important to think it's not just about the commands of God. In the end, it's the commands of God that will interpret and help us understand how to use the design of God. But the design of God is still significant. What God designs things for and what God in his providence has allowed to happen. Those are all things to think about as well. If you think the body is arbitrary and genetic material is arbitrary, then you just mix it all together, anything that works. And if introducing some pig DNA to make something work, you would just do it because it doesn't really matter. But that's, you're now then breaking out of God's sort of general command about species. You're probably breaking out of God's command about murder as well by what you're doing in terms of all the ones you get rid of. But you're kind of breaking out of God's evident design as well. So yeah, lots to think about in that.
Can I just make a point? I don't want to be harsh, but because it talks about that a lot in the Bible, that when people, some ladies couldn't get pregnant, God was in control.
Yes.
God was always in control and closed the womb. So that still happens today, that God does not allow the child, the conception.
Yeah.
But God has allowed for us to deal with that in adoption.
Yeah.
Surely, because adoption is a theme, we're adopted. Adoption is a theme within the Bible, isn't it? So, in one sense, there's no child available to the couple, but in the other hand, God still has allowed this process, which we can go through adoption.
What does anyone else think about that?
So you don't have to go down the IVF route and the surrogacy route.
But, I mean, having your own, everybody wants their own, it's the whole thing, isn't it?
It's their own flesh and blood, is what they say.
I mean, that's something hard to, that would be hard to get over. Not accepting, having that same DNA and a child that they think belongs to you,
Why does it have to be your DNA to belong to you? Why does it have to, why should families just be biological?
But that's, but I'm saying to you, that is what people, I think that would be something that people struggle with. Not saying this here, that's what I think, but.
I'm quite open minded in that respect, as long as it is the two people's things,
yes,
connecting and that's what's put back inside,
yes,
then all right, science has helped in that respect, but it's still there.
But what in the case of like when they have like four, they make four or five like conceived embryos,
yeah,
that's right,
and they shut them all in, chances are they're done, and that's surely along the lines of.
But I think what you're saying, Andy, is you're defining a boundary. You're saying, I'm happy with surrogacy in principle if there was no murder involved and it was only the material. Okay, so I misunderstand you. Okay, misunderstood you.
The problem is that I think that IVF is
it's almost impossible to get single, because even people who tell you it's single.
There are deaths that occur with the best quality of IVF.
Yeah.
And then there are sometimes you get multiple pregnancies and they have to determine how many pregnancies to keep going, and they will actually abort some of those. It's a very, very difficult subject. And for those who are childless, it must be incredibly difficult. I mean, we're childless. I mean, we've been through those thoughts a long time ago now. But
yes,
it's an incredibly difficult subject now because the doctors think they can do so much.
Yes.
And they are, God.
Yeah.
And actually, they can't do that much. The success rates of IVF are still not massive.
We're going to drill down into some of those issues a bit more in other weeks, but it's good to just fly past them and see how it connects with the person through. What were you going to say, Philip?
Those children born like that from IVF, all these things that we're speaking about, are they made in the image of God? It's another question.
I think the answer has got to be yes.
I would agree. but where does that sort of... How does our thinking get affected by it? How do we see it? How do we love... we need to love them too because they're made in the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, God took David. He had an illicit affair with a woman, and yet a subsequent child was in the line to Jesus.
The first child died then.
God is just amazing what he does.
Sure, but that David suffered the consequences of his sin with Bathsheba in terms of what happened in the nation and actually what happened in his own family with all the discord. So what you're really saying is God is extraordinarily gracious, and children born with IVF or with other procedures that we would think are wrong and seriously wrong, God is so gracious that he can bring good out of those situations.
Abraham and Sarah suggested surrogacy. Look what happened.
But don't you think these things have also come about because we are impatient for self-satisfaction?
Yes.
You know, a couple today, I mean, the norm is get married and have children, and then sometimes you do get couples who just cannot have children. And us that do have children seem to like think, I wonder why they don't have any children, and it's got nothing to do with us. But you can be offensive to that person because they have no children.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a friend who's they've decided not to have children, and people are always on the, why aren't you having children? It's got nothing to do with us. But us that have children think everybody else should have children, and that's what's causing the problem.
Then isn't
the
it a Christian? It doesn't God say he wants families? God loves families.
Yeah, but there is
but if you can't,
there's a societal change now where it's get married, enjoy life, and maybe in our 30s we'll think about having some kids because it would be useful just to have a couple of, you know, life as sort of an accessory almost, aren't they?
Yeah.
So we'll do whatever we... So it's not get married at 18, 20, 21 and get or unhappy kids.
There are drivers that mean it...
It's a whole societal change really.
Yeah.
And again, it derives from what you're talking about, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it's often much later. This is not to do with the morality of it, but the practicality is it's often much later that people get married. So statistically, they're less likely to conceive. So, so the time that people are wanting the children is often later in life, so it's harder to do that. I just think, although Roger put it in quite harsh terms, I think what you were saying is... No, like you just said, it might sound a bit harsh, but I have had to have quite a revolution in my thinking in the last few years about that. A number of circumstances, a number of rethinking about the adoption of us by God. In a way, we do have a DNA connection to God, you know, because he's the father of everything. So in a way, we do. But the adoption of us into God's family is much more of a hard ask than us adopting someone who just doesn't happen to have our DNA. It's a much harder ask that God does in adopting us. And I've really been challenged in thinking about my kind of wrong attitudes about the kind of primacy of the sort of biological family and thinking a lot about adoption. So I want you to be challenged too, so I'm not the only one, if you know what I mean. But, you know, there's a lot to think about that. And I know it's really easy. I mean, I was sitting talking to two or three people, you know, including me, who've all had children. So we can pontificate about, you know, all these kind of things. But it doesn't make it wrong just because you have had children. It doesn't make it wrong that you know, are thinking about this and talking about this. I know there's loads of economic reasons, but I was chatting with, you know, Luke and Claire from Grace Church have adopted an extra child. I think they had about four. Now, you could say it's right for them because they've got loads of dosh, they've got a big house, and there is kind of an economic reason. But I was, you know, he can't really afford it. But I was talking to Gareth, who used to work in the cafe, not loads of dosh, small house, hasn't got enough bedrooms, but would actually love to adopt. Because he's kind of got it. He's got three biological kids. Yeah. He's, we call those the biological kids and we call those the adopted. No, but that's the whole point. That he wants to bring them into his family, another adopted person into his family. So, all of that is a long way winded round of saying IVF is not the only option. That there is an idealized, it's a bit like saying, well, you know, how can you make good use of your life if you're single? It's good if you get married. And you're able to get married, that's a good thing, but that might not be God's will for you. It's good if you have kids that are your biological descendants, but maybe God doesn't, in his sovereignty, allow that. So what are you going to do about it? You may say, well, I'm going to make use of my life not having kids, because there's loads of benefits to that, both kind of financially and practically, and I'm going to use that for God's glory. Or you might say, I'm going to adopt. Or you might have a small family of two kids, and you might say, I'm going to adopt another kid, because I want to model what God does. And I don't want to be pregnant again, I don't know what. But anyway, there might be all those things to think about. No, I'm...
I'm going to stop you. This discussion's made me think, Kevin. The guy at work, who him and his wife had IVF and had twins, and obviously what you said about God opening and closing the womb, later, about a year later, they naturally conceived.
Yes.
So, you know, they've been trying for a long time.
Yes.
Whether IVF's impatience or not. They did naturally conceive afterwards, even though they're told they couldn't.
That's happened quite a few
times. Yeah. It does, yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I know families who've... I remember one in particular. And again, because I'm like some... rookie from the country or whatever who never really thought about this, but there was a family that came to our church, where the church I was at, and they adopted a child, and then they conceived two others. And I'm thinking, oh, they must have been really annoyed, you know, because I'm an idiot. I thought, oh, they must have been really annoyed, you know, they got two kids and they've got this adopted one, and what are you going to do with it, you know? He's always going to be kind of the runt, you know. This, bear in mind, I was like, well, I was very immature until I was like 50, but really. But, you know, I was in my teens or something. But, you know, what stupid thinking that was of me to think that they couldn't love the adopted one. It's not all about biology, you know, it's about a commitment a desire to love, a decision, that's what I'm looking for. It's the decision to love. And maybe it's a little bit harder because they don't share your characteristics and you can't have a laugh that they've got your eyes or they've got your smile or they've got your character or they've got your impatience or whatever else my children have got. What's Adam got of mine? Clear thinking and decision making. Yes?
Very quick question. This is not where I stand.
No, I understand.
What about a single person adopting? How does that, would that work? So, no, somebody in my situation, haven't got married yet, don't know whether it's the Lord's will or not, hopefully, but, you know. What about somebody like me or somebody, you know, adopting? Would that, is that a Christian world viewpoint or not? I'm probably saying not.
Yeah, it's a fascinating question, though. I don't think I'd ever thought about that question.
But it's just an interesting one, because another Christian friend has raised that issue, and it's that's an interesting one. Discuss.
I suppose you could say it's one thing to end up as a single parent through relationship breakdown. It's another thing to positively choose to be a single parent, and to say that's what I want to do. And so I suppose I would say in the way God has designed things, children, and it's statistically true, children flourish best in a family of a mother and a father. Statistically, that's true in lots of areas to do with academic achievement and criminality and antisocial behaviour and actually lots of health problems. All the statistics are worse from single parent. Now, it gets complicated because a lot of single parents, there are class issues associated with single parenthood as well, which make it more complicated. Pardon?
Only in recent years,
if you
could actually do
it. Yeah. I get it. It quite so. And that's why I was saying it's more complicated because the statistics are skewed by the fact there's lots of social reasons why this person ended up as a single parent, which also influenced outcomes. You know, because although so the middle and upper classes are not brilliant, there's lots of immorality, there's a different, statistically different. They tend to get married later, but tend to stay married, and there's other things that are happening. There's also other complicated things happening, statistically. Mm-hmm. Having said all that, though, what does anyone else think about Claudia's question?
Is it an outlet?
I think the state can't decide not to do anything these days, so...
Where you're the single sister and your married sister dies and leaves two underage children.
Yes.
And you decide instead of, you know, getting the state to take over those children, you will adopt them as your own.
Yeah.
Surely that should be okay.
Sure.
Yeah.
But then that's not... Yeah. That's the set of circumstances that have led to it. Anybody else want to speak into that question?
The first one of Claudia's question, I believe the father and mother adoption
role. Yeah, I do too. Right. Yes. There we go, wouldn't we? I think
the circumstantial is logical. The desire to do it is because it is now legally possible to do it. It wasn't.
Yeah.
I don't know how many years ago, but now the state says it's impossible because everybody says I've got a right to have a child.
Mm-hmm.
Whether I'm single, whether I'm gay, whatever I am, I can have as many children as I want. So it's that driven by the same route that we started out with persons.
But also, a bit like biblically, I think women, because we were talking about this, I think it was probably even Adam that made the point that, like, biblically, God wants women to be mothers. Like, it's inbuilt
in
women to have children, to want children of their own.
Yeah.
So
You mean more so than men?
No, I just mean like you have like for reasons why a single.
I think it may be true. So I'm saying that because I think it may be true.
Yeah, well, yeah, like
Lord, generally speaking, it's true.
But I mean, as a single, like Lord, you said her friend as like a single.
But does that mean you think a single mother is better than a single father? I'm not being provocative. I'm just.
In what way?
Well, if that's more, if single mothers are more designed for that than single fathers.
I think if you have to pick one of the two, then yeah. Definitely.
Interesting.
100%. Sorry, guys. That's what I think.
But that almost implies that by design, partly because they're the ones who can feed and nourish the baby in early years and have more instinctive ability.
Yeah.
Partly, that's partly recognising the design of God, not so much the command of God.
Yeah, but if we weren't supposed to have children, if we weren't supposed to, like, we wouldn't be the ones that carried them for 9 months, fed them for years on end.
But you are having those, and in Monday you have those weird TV shows where the bloke actually gets pregnant, which is just odd. but that's not what it's supposed to be.
Or in the transgender, because I knew a couple who were transgender, so the boy was a girl and a girl was a boy, but they one of them, the girl who was then a boy, had a baby, but like was pregnant, so it was the biological mother, yet she was legally a boy. And the mum and the same vice versa. It was
Do you know the majority of transgender people, by the way, haven't actually had the operations that change the organs by a long way, which is a real issue in prisons and so forth. Can I ask? I just need to answer someone before they go to bed. But I'm just going to ask a question. 4:30, yes or no? Tomorrow.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Good.
All right.
It's in the evening.
I'm dead in your notes. Let me write that down.
Right, I've answered yes, please. That's the only thing I'm going to do.
Can you tell people yet?
Okay, me and Caroline are going to have a baby. And it's coming at 4:30 tomorrow.
Caleb.
Oh, that'd be a good name. Oh, I could call my dog Caleb. I'm having a puppy, another dog, so... Amy and the kids want to come along and pick up. So that was what the question was about. The bloke's just asking, can you come at 4:30? So I just had to say yes.
Never
visited. Yeah, that's fine. What about Caleb for a name for a dog? Roger, you've put me in. You've put the dog amongst the pigeons, as it were, because we were kind of settling on Toby.
Should dogs have names?
Should dogs have names? They need something to be referred to. Right.
I said Davey, but no one wanted that. Davey. Lola. Like, shout across the park. Like, Dave.
Nobody wanted Dave, Amy. Nobody with any sense.
Get over it.
Yeah, someone will have to edit that. Right. The second page is much quicker because it's very familiar ground. But what I wanted to do very quickly was having... it's another 3/4 of an hour. What I wanted to do, having... kind of set out this whole person body thing, and we can now revisit it a few times in the topics and stretch it out and hold it up to the light and everything else. But I just wanted to remind you of a Christian anthropology.
Oh.
Where does anthropology? We're going to be another 10 minutes. We said we'd run to 9:30. Sorry. Pardon?
Nothing.
Were you answering the definition of anthropology?
Yeah.
Okay.
Human
yes, it is. What's it derived from then, Mia? Where does the word come from? What's the etymology of the word?
Greek.
Yes, it is. Yes. The Greek word...
Anthropos.
Yes, it has to do with the...
Ology humans. Is study or...
Quite so. You are so clever. That SGP course has done wonders for you. So just to remind you what we did in the Humanity series, the Doctrine of God. Doctrine of Man, sorry. The doctrine of what it is to be human. So, three things, made in his image, made male and female, and marriage being part of a bigger story. So just very quickly, and then we'll kind of wrap up. Made in his image, it's there in Genesis 1 and 2, it's reflected in other times that it's quoted through the rest of the Bible. So made in the image of God, and if you remember at the time we said, what does that mean? It means we're rational, it means we think, we're conscious, we're abstract, we're creative, some more than others, we're moral, with an innate sense of right and wrong. But this new puppy and my old dog, and actually any other well-trained dog, has no sense of morality and right and wrong. They might have a sense of consequences. They've nicked the cheese, so they look guilty, but they have no ultimate sense of a kind of outrage or shame about it, or thinking about the sort of consequences for the world at large. Whereas we do have a sense of that. And we're relational. That's part of being made in God's image, that we have a desire to love and to be loved. But also we're made to rule. So we're made rational, but also we're made to rule with a mandate to fill, subdue, and to rule over, to look after, to tend the garden that is the world. And the thing is, it's not our souls that are given this responsibility, it's the whole person, body and soul. The embodied soul is given the job of ruling the world and being rational and all those things. So in the Bible's view of things, yes, there is the soul, which is the eternal self, which lives on and will be reunited with a resurrected body. So there is the eternal self, the you that never kind of switches off, that's always there. There is that entity which is not material. Absolutely, we believe in an immaterial soul. And we have a higher view, in fact, of the soul than the world has of the self. But for this life, the soul is never considered in distinction from the body, as though the body was something different. Because the soul is where the body, the body is where the soul resides. And that's why, you see, the right to life comes from us being image bearers. You know, in it's the kind of post-Noah command, Genesis 9, verse 6, that we shouldn't kill other human beings because they're made in the image of God. Now, this is pretty interesting because if you just have a view that the soul is the important bit and the body doesn't matter, you could say, well, it doesn't really matter much because the soul lives on anyway. But it's as though the body is made in the image of God as well. It's as though the combination of soul and body is the image of God. So we have a much higher view of the body as well as we have a much higher view of the soul than this kind of thinking. And also, we've already touched on it, so I'll do it quick. The design of the body indicates purpose. It's not just an arbitrary vessel that can just do whatever it can do. It's designed with clear purpose. So we have what you'd call a distinct kind of dualism. There's the soul and there's the body. If you look at Psalm 63 verse 1, you look at Psalm 44 verse 25, it talks about the two in distinction, that both the soul and the body. But it often uses them as parallel. It will say, my soul yearns, my body yearns. So it will take them as distinctive, but it will also sometimes talk about them as kind of, in a sense, doing the same things, kind of running in parallel. And these bodies will be resurrected bodies in the new heavens and new earth. Okay, on that, before I do made male and female, I'm going well quick now, aren't I? Made male and female, alike, equal in created status, equal as image bearers, made male and female, different, equipped for different roles, perhaps women equipped, no, not perhaps, women equipped for childbearing without a doubt, women, the weaker vessel, whatever that means, in wherever it. So made different, but the same in creation, the same in salvation, but different in roles. And I think what happens, just to do with male and female, it's really interesting. I'm really interested by this topic. I don't know whether you guys are, but what's really interesting is you get a combination, even to do with male and female, with a convergence of the command of God and the design of God. So there's the command of God about how men and women behave, but then you've got the design of God, which is, and you can overplay this, but it's kind of how we're designed as men and women. You see what I mean?
They both relate to each other, don't they?
Yeah. But it works in terms of not so much character and characteristics, because you can be really crass about that and say, you know, blokes can't like flower arranging or something, and all that kind of stupid stuff. It's just rubbish, right? Mm-hmm. But in broad brush terms, the things that God commands men to do, men generally are designed to do. And the things that God commands women to do, women are generally designed to do. So you've got a convergence of design and command. Mm-hmm. I think it's really useful to think about that, because Otherwise, you've just got command that seems arbitrary. You know, like, God tells me to do this, but actually, you know, I'm designed for something different. Well, that's a load of rubbish. No, actually, you're designed to do what God calls you to do. I'm quite excited about that. Made male and female. Gender is not a social construct. That's right. Nick will use that the whole time, so he won't be bursting out before 9:30. Are we laughing at? Gender is not a social construct. When we start to get rid of the design of God and the command of God, though, that's when you get gender wars and the general social breakdown that we've got. I know I mentioned it before, but loads of secular writers now, people like Brendan O'Neill, who writes Spiked, and he also writes in The Spectator, who's a kind of a left wing, so he's not kind of some old conservative or whatever, he's the kind of young guy's left wing, completely understands that feminism has imploded, because once you decide that there's really no difference between men and women, and women deserve the same rights and the same things as men, the logical conclusion of that is they are no different, so women don't deserve any rights because they're no different. which is what is happening, and what's happening with transgender. So you've got feminists who are appalled that blokes, basically, with all their bits, who just say, "I'm a woman," are allowed to go into girls' changing rooms. But the feminists have absolutely no argument against that, because it's just what they've been arguing for, that there is no difference. So that whole thing is just imploding. You know, people who are not Christians can see this is just going crazy. There's nowhere for this to go but, like, bad. Remember the gospel. Third thing, marriage is part of a bigger story. So we're made in the image of God. We're made male and female, and marriage itself is part of creation's design and not a social construct. One man, one woman, is that what you've got in your notes? In an exclusive and lifelong relationship. Because you've done the bit of work on the command and the design coming together, you think, well, God is good, so that must be true for marriage as well. That God must command us, as a general rule, to seek to live in a lifelong covenant with a person of the opposite sex, to bring up children, to be the place where families flourish. God must have both commanded that, but also equipped us to do that, and made us people who would want to do that, generally speaking. So it's not an oppressive command. Now, of course, we all know and have understood, you know, breakups are those, and the world's bent out of shape, so it doesn't always happen. And there is, you know, forgiveness and restoration and new opportunities and all those things. But that doesn't make the essential command wrong. And it's generally how God's designed us. All sex outside of the covenant of marriage between a man and a woman. Why is it wrong? It's wrong because it goes against God's plan to fulfill our role to rule the world under God. It misuses the intended purpose of sex. And, finally, it can't reflect the covenant love of God in Christ for his church.